You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, new research shows that even if you're terrified to speak in another language, it may be the best way for you to improve your skills. First, after turning into one of the most divisive issues of the 2017 football season, the NFL now has a new policy for what players can and can't do on the field during the national anthem. This new policy, approved by the league last week, comes in response to players like Colin Kaepernick, who opted to kneel during the anthem to protest police brutality against African Americans. Here's NFL Commissioner Robert Goodell explaining the policy last week.
We think that we've come up with a balanced process here and a procedure and policy that will allow those players who feel that they can't stand for the anthem to stay in the locker room.
Robert O'Connell is a sports writer based in Minneapolis. His work has appeared in The Guardian, Esquire, and The Atlantic. His most recent piece for The Atlantic is titled "The NFL Tries to Push Protest Out of Sight." Robert, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So remind us briefly, how did this protest with Colin Kaepernick start, and what was it all about?
Well, originally, Colin Kaepernick was, like you said, just protesting police brutality against the African-American community. And he began by simply taking a knee during the national anthem. And it kind of quickly snowballed into, you know, it was referred to as the anthem protest, and his detractors would say he was protesting the anthem itself, when really that was just the most visible time for him to protest police brutality.
And so what does this new policy say specifically about what players can and cannot do during the playing of the national anthem?
Well, in keeping with the NFL's MO, it's kind of vague and gives a lot of jurisdiction for Roger Goodell to kind of punish as he sees fit, potentially. But I believe the phrasing is, "All team and league personnel on the field shall stand and show respect for the flag and the anthem." And like the clip you played suggested, if players don't feel comfortable doing that, they can stay in the locker room.
And so presumably the anthem would play, players who are out on the field would be expected to stand in a respectful manner. Those who are in the locker room would then come out after, and the game would start. What happens if a player does stay on the field or goes onto the field and then does protest in some way that is considered not showing the proper respect?
Well, that's kind of an interesting thing. They don't, at least in Goodell's statement the other day, they've said that they won't be fining the players directly. Rather, they'll be fining the teams that the players are on. And then they give the teams themselves leeway to penalize the players as they see fit. But yeah, I think that's kind of a way of, distancing themselves from conflict with the Players Association, potentially, even though the Players Association has said that they'll be looking into if this violates their bargaining agreement. Yeah, so the direct fines will go to the team, and then the team is allowed to discipline players as need be.
Hmm. What kind of reactions have we heard from players so far?
They've kind of run the gamut. There have been some players who have just been given out quotes like, "We're very focused on football and we're glad this is behind us." But there have been a lot of players who are vocally disappointed by the NFL's stance. I believe Torrey Smith of the Panthers, I think, said today that this made all of Colin Kaepernick's work to raise this issue, it kind of made it be in vain, made it go for naught. And he's just one in a chorus of players expressing similar sentiments.
What about coaches and owners? What are we hearing from them?
Owners, as you might expect, are broadly behind Goodell's statement, given that they voted on it. Although it's interesting, in the initial reports said that 31 of 32 owners agreed to this or voted in support of this kind of resolution. And in the days following, it was revealed that there was no official vote. There was just kind of an informal tally from which they figured how an official vote would go, and they thought that was good enough to move on. One interesting exception is Christopher Johnson, chairman of the New York Jets, has said that if the Jets get fined for any player's actions on the sidelines during the national anthem, he himself will be paying those fines. He won't pass those fines along to the players.
Hmm. So one of the things that you wrote about in your piece, "The NFL Tries to Push Protest Out of Sight," is you say that the NFL has traditionally, when faced with conflict, tried to separate what is in public view on the playing field and what is away from public view in the locker room. And this policy you see as fitting into that. Can you explain that for us?
Sure. Yeah. I think it's kind of no secret among people who follow sports that the last decade plus has not been great for the NFL on a PR front. And they've had, unfortunately, from their perspective, they've had a lot of practice in dealing with controversy, most notably being the concussion controversy and then more recently the anthem controversy. And in each case, I think, you know, Roger Goodell's quote, one of his quotes in the statement was, "We believe today's decision will keep our focus on the game and the extraordinary athletes who play it and on our fans who enjoy it." And I think you can kind of see that impulse in a lot of their reactions to various scandals over the years. I wrote about how, you know, they try to keep the symptoms of concussed players out of sight. They have these medical tents on the sidelines or they usher them away to the locker room. Similarly, instead of dealing with kind of the optics is a catchphrase they like to use. Instead of dealing with the optics of the protests on their sidelines, it's simplest for them to just have it kind of go away.
We're talking with Robert O'Connell. He's a sports writer based in Minneapolis, and his most recent piece for The Atlantic is titled "The NFL Tries to Push Protest Out of Sight." And Robert, just kind of following that thread that we were just talking about, you know, the NFL is seeing lagging attendance, lower viewership on television. There is the concussion issue that is not going away. There is the issue of protests. You write that it seems that the NFL is trying to maybe recreate or create this kind of idyllic situation that fans don't kind of have to be bothered by anything troubling, and therefore that's also protecting the bottom line for the owners.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's an interesting, it's obviously an interesting time in the sports world, as it's an interesting time in the world in general, but to draw a kind of parallel or contrast with the NBA. The NBA is often held up as the NFL's opposite in this regard. Their players, for the most part, are invited and even encouraged at times to be outspoken on social issues. And the NBA is in one of its most successful periods in its history. It's a very, you know, the NFL has opted to go in one direction. Other leagues have opted to go in others, and you can kind of see some results of that.
Why do you think the NFL is where it is versus, like you said, the NBA?
It's painting with a broad brush, and I don't have any numbers handy to back this up, but the NFL, I think its fan base certainly skews to the right of the NBA's fan base. And I think its average customer is less interested maybe in having his or her favorite player speak out than an NBA fan would be.
As we said, the issue of these protests going on during the national anthem at NFL games started with Colin Kaepernick, and he has not been able to find work with a team, and he and his former teammate are actually suing the league, saying that the league conspired to keep them unemployed because of their protests, because of their expression of this sentiment and this social justice issue. What does that say about where the league stands on this? And do we know, is there evidence that they were conspired against?
Well, to my thinking, there's certainly evidence that Colin Kaepernick is one of the best 30 people alive at playing NFL quarterback. And that's only for starting positions. So if you take into account second and third stringers, there's no real reason outside of the protest that Colin Kaepernick shouldn't have a job. So in my opinion, he absolutely has a case. I think the fact that they no longer have jobs, it speaks to the NFL's mindset. It speaks to wanting to maintain this illusion. And it also, obviously, it all became, you know, the stakes became much higher last fall when President Trump tweeted about the players who were protesting. And so Colin Kaepernick went from, he was already a very divisive figure, but became kind of the eye of this storm. And for individual owners, they probably believe that he's not worth the PR hit. But from an outsider's perspective, and my own perspective, it's unforgivable that he doesn't have a job because he absolutely deserves one.
Mm-hmm. And as we wrap up, Robert, looking into your crystal ball, looking at the start of the NFL season coming up just in a few months, what do you think is going to happen? Are there going to be players that stay in the locker room? Are there going to be players that decide to stay on the field and protest? What do you think we're going to see in those first games?
I think it's anybody's guess. There have been players who have said they won't let this ruling stop them. Dwayne Smoot of Jacksonville tweeted out when the news broke, he said, "Find me. You can't change my opinion and you can't stop my protest." There's even been, I haven't vetted these very carefully, I've just seen them in the last couple hours, but there have been reports that certain players are talking about even sitting out games until Kaepernick and his teammate Eric Reed, or his former teammate Eric Reed, have jobs. So I don't think we've heard the end of this. I think if anything, the owner's actions may just make the protests all the more urgent and relevant to the continued goings-on of the league.
Well, Robert, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Robert O'Connell is a sports writer based in Minneapolis. His work has appeared in The Guardian, Esquire, and The Atlantic. His most recent piece for The Atlantic is titled "The NFL Tries to Push Protest Out of Sight," and he was with us to talk about the NFL's newly announced protest policy. First, if you've ever tried to learn a new language, whether you had to in school or you wanted to later in life, I'm guessing the experience went something like this. You sat in a classroom, studied grammar and vocabulary, and listened to a fluent speaker give examples of the right way to speak. While there are elements of that method that are useful and maybe even necessary, students are often not pushed to speak as much at lower levels, in part because there's a fear of them making mistakes and then repeating them until they become part of the learner's language use. But new research out of UW-Madison is looking at whether speaking more in a new language can actually increase comprehension when we hear others speaking. Mary Ellen McDonald is the Donald P. Hayes Professor of Psychology at the University of Wisconsin. She studies how people comprehend, produce, and learn language, and she's with us in the studio. Mary Ellen, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So what happens in our brains when we're learning a new language?
Well, our brains change, because every bit of learning changes our brains, and we begin to make connections to different cultures, we begin to relate different words, we learn new words for things, we realize that, hey, this new language doesn't have a word that my language seems to have,
or vice versa.
Yes. And we learn that sentences can get scrambled in all kinds of ways in different languages than the one our language that we're used to.
So there are several components of language learning, and I kind of referred to some of them. There's learning vocabulary, so what are things called in another language? There are rules of grammar, how do we put those words together so they make sense to the listener? There's comprehension, and that's both of written or spoken language. And then there's speaking ourselves, actually expressing ourselves. And I'm sure I'm forgetting some other elements too, but how do all those different things fit together for us to actually be able to use a language?
Well, they fit together amazingly tightly. And in fact, language instruction researchers often think about, well, now today we're going to teach vocabulary, and then later in the day, maybe in the last 10 minutes, we'll teach a bit of grammar. But the vocabulary and the grammar are really tightly wound up together, because certain words can go in certain kinds of sentences and others can't. And unconsciously, when we learn our native language, we learn that linking between the words and the grammar, but often in foreign language instruction, those things are treated separately. That almost discourages linking them together.
Mm-hmm. It does seem like, at least like older styles of teaching languages, it was very much like, we're going to memorize this list of words and we're going to learn this one little isolated grammar thing, instead of looking at, like you said, the patterns. And once you figure out some patterns, you take a big jump up in understanding how a language works.
That's right. Exactly.
Let's dive into your research. What did you find out about the value of students constructing and speaking their own sentences instead of just repeating the perfectly constructed sentence of the native or at least fluent speaker that's teaching them?
Right. Well, my graduate student, Elise Hauptmann, and I designed an experiment to test the hypothesis that speaking could make you a better comprehender than practicing comprehension itself. So we designed an experiment in which we randomly assigned people to be either a comprehension learner or a speaking learner. And we had equal amount of experience in these two groups. And then we tested everybody on comprehension of this made-up language that everybody had to learn.
You actually made up a language, so it was a really level playing field.
Yes. So we made up a language, and this is not totally uncommon in a language learning study because researchers want to have exact control over what people are going to learn and want to create a level playing field for everybody. And so we make up a little language that's not like any common language that we know, but isn't impossibly complicated either.
Mm-hmm. And so you have these two groups that are divided so you can compare how well they learn this made-up language. So the learners that were learning in the more traditional way, how were they learning the language?
They were doing things that were kind of like worksheets, except they were on the computer. So they would see a picture, and they would hear some of the made-up language, and they said yes or no, whether the picture and the language that they heard were correctly matched. And then they got feedback, and whether they were wrong or right, they heard the correct language to go with that picture.
And how about the other group?
And so then the producers just saw that same picture, and they had to produce the little word or phrase or whole sentence that described that picture themselves. And then, no matter how accurate they were, they heard the correct sentence or word or whatever it was they should have said.
So they could have gotten it exactly right, and they would have heard the confirmation of that, or they could have been miles wrong.
That's right.
But they would still hear the right one.
Or silent. Some people were too embarrassed to say anything for a while.
So I have to say, I have studied a few languages. I've studied Russian, I've studied French, and Russian is really hard. I'll just put that out there. It's hard to feel at all proficient. But I have always, for whatever reason, I have always just spoken. Whereas there were people who were learning at the same time I was who were actually much better at the language, but they would get that tongue tied, I don't want to make a mistake. And it really held them back. And I made so many mistakes, I can't even count, and probably a lot I didn't even know I was making. But I still had that kind of fluency just because I was speaking. Is that kind of what you're finding?
Yes. So we created a situation so that, as you said, no matter how accurate or inaccurate people were, they always heard the right answer. And that combination of forcing people to speak and then tuning up whatever it was they said turns out to be really powerful in terms of making people more fluent.
We're talking with Mary Ellen McDonald. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she studies how people comprehend, produce, and learn language. And Mary Ellen, is there a point? So you created a language. I still just love that. You created a language to be able to test this with the two groups. Do you know if there's a point where, as people get more advanced in a language, is there a point where the more traditional type of learning starts to become more effective after they kind of have that baseline of where they've been producing the language themselves? Or is your research looking like, this is the way to go for learning from literally word one to being fluent in that language?
Well, our research doesn't answer that question, but I think we can think a little bit about other aspects of language learning in the world for hints of that. So people know that being immersed in a language is a wonderful way to become fluent. And one of the major differences between immersion and classroom kinds of instruction is that the people who are immersed have to go about their day speaking and speaking and speaking. And they're not in only the early phases of learning. In fact, people who typically go abroad and spend a semester or a year in a foreign country learning a foreign language are much more advanced than that, and that is supposed to be incredibly helpful to making those people even more fluent. So I would predict that while there might be different mixes of perfect curriculum at different times of learning, producing is going to be really important for a long part of the learning process.
I think there's a belief that's very commonly held that once you're past a certain age, whether it's 6 or 12 or 18, that it's practically impossible to learn a new language. What would you say to adult learners who would really like to learn a language but feel like, oh, you know, my brain's just too old for that?
No, you're not too old for that. You might be too old to find your keys to get to the language class, but you're not going to be too old to learn language. You probably, your pronunciation will not be as good as somebody who's learning at 6. And if you're deeply embarrassed about never having perfect, perfect pronunciation, then maybe you shouldn't stick your toe in a foreign language. But in fact, most people are wonderfully happy to have non-native speakers attempt to produce their language and are happy to have their country opened up to foreign visitors. So you can learn, especially if you get brave and produce a lot, you can learn a foreign language.
So start learning and start talking and never stop talking.
Right.
Mary Ellen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Mary Ellen McDonald is the Donald P. Hayes Professor of Psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She studies how people comprehend, produce, and learn languages and joined us to share new research on the best ways to improve our second language skills. And if you've had experience learning a language and if you've managed to get over that hesitation of speaking, let us know about your experiences. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or you can tweet us at CentralTimeWPR. First, for the last week, two news stories regarding children who cross the U.S. border illegally and unaccompanied have garnered national attention. One story involves a recent lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union, which alleges widespread abuse of children along the border. The other story that made headlines was a report that claimed that some 1,500 children taken into custody along the border fell through the cracks and are unaccounted for. Authorities with the Department of Health and Human Services disputed that claim earlier this week. But these two stories, both involving the way children are allegedly treated when they cross the border, illuminates possible issues with America's immigration system and what rights children have when they do make it to the states. Uzumaka Enzalibe is a clinical associate professor of law at Northwestern University School of Law and is also a staff attorney with the Children and Family Justice Center of the Bloom Legal Clinic. Uzumaka, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Judith, for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
So let's start with that news story that has gotten so much attention, the 1,500 children that were allegedly lost by immigration authorities. We want to start with this because this issue has been refuted by the Department of Health and Human Services. So help us get to the truth here. What has happened with these children? What's the situation?
So let's take a step back for just a moment, and let me just sort of tell you who these children are. So when children are found at or near our border or apprehended at or near our border, the U.S. government detains them, and the agency that's sort of responsible for detaining these children is the Office of Refugee Resettlement. These children are detained until the government can find a sponsor, and usually the sponsor is a parent or other relative. And then these children are released to the sponsor, but when they are released, they still sort of have to keep their immigration case going. So release to a sponsor doesn't necessarily mean that you have the right to remain in the United States. And so what the Office of Refugee Resettlement does is that it does like a follow-up call 30 days after a child is released from custody. And this sort of 1,500 number sort of came up as a result of some testimony given by Stephen Wagner. And basically what he was talking about was that between October 2017 and December 2017, the Office of Refugee Resettlement called about 7,635 kids. And when they placed these calls, about 6,000 kids remained with their sponsors, but about 1,475 kids, or about 19% of the kids, couldn't determine the whereabouts of those 1,500 kids. Now, there could be lots of different reasons why those 1,500 kids, their whereabouts couldn't be determined. What my sense is that the rhetoric around sort of targeting sponsors and you know, the Trump administration has said that they will sort of go after sponsors for smuggling kids, may make it very difficult for people to sort of answer calls from the government, right? So if the government comes calling to ask about the kids, one reaction somebody might have is, look, I don't want to talk, I don't want to participate in this follow-up call. Another common thing that I've seen just through my practice is that my clients tend to change their numbers frequently. So I've had the same cell phone number for many years, but I will say that, you know, in representing a client for like 5 years, that during that 5-year period, the client may have like 5 or 6 different numbers because maybe they have like a pay-as-you-go phone. Mm-hmm. And so that those are some sort of plausible explanations why these 1,500 kids are missing. And, you know, I think the news that we've seen sort of suggests that they're kind of like lost or they went on a field trip and all of them disappeared. But what really is happening is that the government is calling after really harsh rhetoric about the things that they will do to sponsors. And some people are not responding, which sort of makes sense.
And also, I want to back up just a little bit because it feels like it was probably about 1.5 years, maybe 2 years ago that we were hearing about the numbers of unaccompanied minors at the border increasing drastically and there being a real problem with trying to move them through the system and you know, that there was this backup. Are these some of the kids that we're talking about?
Sure. So these are the kids that are part of the surge, but they could also be kids that are sort of more, because it's a 30-day follow-up call. I'm suspecting that most kids only spend about 50 days in OR custody and detention, and so these are probably kids who crossed the border more recently if the call was being made between October 2017 and December 2017. But all of these kids that are coming for the same reasons, right? So we experienced a surge in 2014 because the kids were fearful of a lot of gangs in Central America. And so these kids are probably coming for the same reasons that those kids came for in 2014.
As you said, a lot of these children are coming unaccompanied, but that doesn't mean that they don't have family or relatives here in the U.S. already. They might be coming later than those other family members, and that they are often released into the care of one of those adults that they have a relationship with. What do those adults need to do to become that sponsor, to be able to prove that they are a person who should be allowed to collect a particular child?
So a lot of times the adults that are stepping forward are parents, and so the ORR will do a background check, and sometimes if there's a red flag, for whatever reason, ORR may take a step further and do sort of a home study. If the person who's stepping forward to sponsor the child is not a parent or maybe just a relative or a family friend, there's probably a little bit more of a check done just to make sure this person is safe and it's somebody that the child should be released to.
We're talking with Uzomaka Enzalibe. She's a clinical associate professor of law at Northwestern University School of Law, and she's also a staff attorney with the Children and Family Justice Center of the Bloom Legal Clinic. And so the Office of Refugee Resettlement, or as you were saying, what is their general track record with children? Is this an organization that has proven itself able to dispose these cases well and to keep track of the children that they have in some way become responsible for?
You know, the ORR has had some problems in the past. There was a case of kids being released to sponsors in Ohio, and it turned out that they were, you know, being forced to work under horrific conditions. So ORR has had those problems in the past, but a vast majority of kids are being released to their parents, and so I think we have to strike a balance between making sure that the people who the kids are being released to are safe, but also not keeping kids in detention, right? So I, as an advocate for children, I want kids to be released to safe environments, but I also don't want kids to spend an inordinate amount of time in ORR custody, which is, you know, really just, a detention as far as my clients are concerned. And so that has to be balanced. Those two things have to be balanced, not having kids in detention, but also making sure that kids are being placed safely.
So if kids are in detention, what does that mean exactly? Are they in a group setting? Are they, you know, is it kind of, as we would imagine, a detention center for adults, except everyone is a minor?
So, no. And when I say detention, I'm speaking from the perspective of the children that I represent, which is any time that you're not allowed to leave when you want to, and you're sort of there, that the door is closed, it feels like detention. But a vast majority of the kids are kept in group homes. And ORR does have some facilities that are sort of more secure facilities, but most kids are kept in group homes. And what that looks like, when I used to go to the detention center to do intakes and human rights presentations, is that they're bunk beds and kids have like a uniform that they wear and they have times that they're supposed to eat. And there's maybe some English as a second language classes that, you know, that they try to provide to kids with lots of different proficiencies. But I think what makes a detention is how some of the kids feel who are there, which is that you can't just open the door and step outside and sort of walk around when you want to.
And there have been some concerns that some of those children, the 1,500 who cannot be accounted for, that some of them may have been trafficked. And certainly there's a growing awareness of trafficking and that it may be much more common, unfortunately, than we may have thought. What are the safeguards in place to make sure that children who are in this vulnerable position are not ending up being trafficked or in other, you know, equally horrible situations?
So I think there are places in the system where they do sort of specifically screen for trafficking. From the time a child enters at the border officials who interact with that child should screen for trafficking. And while the child is in ORR custody, that child should also be screened for trafficking. And then ORR should also do a background check and screen for trafficking. But I think, as a lawyer, that kids who have lawyers, right, and are represented, mm-hmm. do well, right? They report, they go to court. The lawyer kind of provides that safeguard because the person is coming in to talk to an adult about their case, and that really kids should not be navigating the system without lawyers. And having a lawyer in place goes a long way in making sure that kids not only have their day in court and their due process rights are protected, but also kind of make sure the kids are safe and are participating in their legal process.
And how do kids get a lawyer? And who are the kids that don't have access to one?
Sure. So we don't have a right to appointed counsel in immigration, so because it's considered a civil proceeding. And a lot of times the kids that I represent, the way that I find out about them is sometimes when they're released from the detention center, I may get a call from the detention center saying that a kid has been released. Oftentimes, kids are relying on their sponsors to go and seek legal help. And so kids are particularly vulnerable because so many times they are relying on adults to sort of do the right things, to take them to court, to seek legal help. And the kids who are not represented are the kids who aren't able to find lawyers. And my concern is that a lot of kids who may be outside of very big cities go unrepresented because the ability to find a lawyer in those places is extremely difficult.
Well, and their sponsors may have a very hard time negotiating and navigating that system themselves.
Yes, certainly. That, you know, we are expecting kids to do something incredibly complicated. I always joke that my students who are often second and third year law students don't quite understand how to get asylum, and they've had one solid year of law school, let alone the kids who may have very little formal education and their sponsors, and now add to that, you know, just sort of the lack of information, but also the fear, because there's so many rumors of policies that are coming down that says if we find you, we will deport you. And so it just makes it so difficult for both the sponsors and the kids to seek help. And so I think these policies will have an incredibly detrimental effect because we now have people who are living in the shadows. And what we know is that when people live in the shadows, lots of bad things can happen in the shadows. So, you know, those policies also have that effect.
We're talking with Uzumaka Nzalibe right now. She's a clinical associate professor of law at Northwestern University School of Law. She's also a staff attorney with the Children and Family Justice Center of the Bloom Legal Clinic. And she's with us to talk about what rights children have when they cross into the U.S. illegally. And that's in light of two major news stories. The first being the 1,500 children that are alleged to be missing by U.S. immigration authorities. And the second is a new report from the ACLU alleging the abuse of children by Border Control. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What do you make of these two stories? What questions do you have about these issues? And what do you think should change? Or do you think that immigration authorities are acting as they should? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We continue our conversation now about the rights children have when they cross the border into the United States illegally, as well as issues that these children face that brought them here and the challenges that await them. Our guest is Uzumaka Enzalibe. She is a clinical associate professor of law at Northwestern University School of Law and is also a staff attorney with the Children and Family Justice Center of the Bloom Legal Clinic. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think these stories say about how the United States handles immigration issues? Are you for or against the practices that are currently in place at the border? We'd like your questions and your opinions. Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Uzumaka, let's move on to the ACLU story. That's the other story that's been making the rounds. It regards a recent report released by the American Civil Liberties Union, which alleges that children that have crossed the border have faced widespread abuse. They point to abuse from border control during the Obama administration. And I know it can be difficult to talk about and for people to hear, but what kind of abuse are we talking about that's been alleged?
So I would say that the report kind of pointed to sort of excessive use of force. So there were incidents where they reported that kids were kicked in the head or tasers were used inappropriately. And also the report kind of pointed to sort of a lot of verbal abuse. So they kids were called, you know, things that you and I can't say on public radio. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be said to any child, especially a child who's fleeing a traumatic situation in their home country and coming to the United States to seek protection, as well as incidents where children were subjected to sort of inappropriate touching by CPB officials. And so the report kind of detailed some of these complaints that children had made and was sort of tracking to see what happened to the complaints after they were made.
And how did the ACLU get the information, the documents that led to these allegations?
So the ACLU's Border Litigation Project FOIA'd about the Freedom of Information Act, so requested documents from the government through this sort of providing public documents, and they received about 30,000 pages of records relating to children in CPB custody or Customs and Border Protection custody, and have been kind of sifting through this information to sort of put together a report that details what they found by reviewing the report.
And do we have a sense of the scope of this over how long a period of time, how many agents or agencies were involved? Do we have a sense?
Sure. So the report, I think, covers a period between 2009 and 2014. And part of that period is sort of at the height of the surge. So the surge kind of happened in fiscal year 2014. And when I say surge, I'm talking about the large numbers of kids who were crossing the border and seeking protection in 2014. And most of the records that were requested. So when a child crosses the border, they are apprehended by Customs and Border Protection, and CPB usually takes them to a border facility or these temporary detention centers where they are processed. And CPB is trying to figure out, first, how old the person is, two, if the person is from a contiguous country like Mexico or Canada, or from non-contiguous country everywhere else, if the person has been trafficked. And they have 72 hours to transfer that child from their temporary detention centers to the custody of the Office of Refugee Resettlement so that the Office of Refugee Resettlement can then detain that child until they're able to place them with the sponsor. So this report kind of zones in on the time that child, the 72-hour period where that child is being processed and asked those questions and being held until these preliminary questions can be answered and so they can be transferred into the ORR's custody.
These two stories really highlight the confusion that a lot of people have when it comes to children and immigration. And you did say earlier, Uzumaka, that these children are not guaranteed legal representation. But are there rights that they are guaranteed, whether it's under U.S. law or international human rights law, when these minors are crossing the border unaccompanied or with their parents illegally?
Sure. So when kids come to our country asking for protection, we need to keep them safe while they move through our system. And so under our laws, when a child comes in, one of the things that we've agreed to is that we're going to keep them in the least restrictive environment possible, right? And so we're going to try as much as possible to not detain them for long periods of time and to release them to people like their family members or their family friends, because we feel that that move is in the best interest of the child. We also have, just under our Refugee Act of 1980, which is the law that talks about how people can seek asylum in the United States, people have, if you're coming to the United States, you can ask for asylum. In fact, you cannot get asylum status unless you are in the United States or you are at a port of entry. And so people have a right to ask for asylum, which is, you know, as an immigration attorney, which is what I find a little bit, I can't understand, because I think there's a lot of confusion about people are entering illegally. I have a lot of clients who sort of present themselves and ask and say, look, I need help, right? And when someone says, I need help, we should ensure that they're safe while we figure out how to help them. And right now, we're not doing a very good job of keeping families and children safe while we figure out how to help them.
And Uzumaka, when will we know more about this ACLU suit? Is it going to be moving through the courts soon? If you could just answer briefly.
Sure. I think, you know, my understanding is that they're looking at the records right now, and they're working with the University of Chicago to sort of release this information and make people aware of what their findings are. And I'm not so sure about the lawsuit and how it's going to progress.
Well, Uzumaka, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a really complicated topic, and we really appreciate you helping us sort through it.
Thank you very much for having me.
Uzumaka Nzalibe is a clinical associate professor of law at Northwestern University School of Law. She's also a staff attorney with the Children and Family Justice Center of the Bloom Legal Clinic. She joined us today to talk about the rights children have or don't have when they cross the border illegally into the United States. We were focusing in on this topic because there have been recent reports of abuse on the U.S. border, as well as allegations that immigration authorities lost track of some 1,500 children who had crossed over either with parents or unaccompanied and that have been lost track of in the system. That report has been distributed by the authorities. You can let us know what you think about this topic by tweeting us at Central Time WPR. Let us know what you think the next steps in these cases should be.